So my name is Brian Keller. Thank you for coming. This is the first of three talks I'll be doing this week. This is Visual Studio 2010 Application Lifecycle Management Capabilities. So I am a technical evangelist for Visual Studio. I work on application lifecycle management back in Redmond. And this talk is basically going to be a survey of some of the major new areas that we're delivering on for application lifecycle management with 2010. I do believe that the agenda lists this as a talk for architects and testers. If I'm not mistaken. However, this is really meant for everybody. So whether you're an architect, you're a tester, you're a developer, really I've got something for everyone in here. And most importantly, what I hope you'll take back is even if you're not an architect and I'm showing an architect capability, I hope you'll take this back to your team and tell whoever is responsible for architecture about some of the things that we're doing here. This session is being recorded, so I understand that it will be posted and made available online later this week. In my next two sessions after this, I'll be focusing exclusively on software testing. So we're doing a lot in the product around helping manual testers to go out and file bugs and run manual tests and collect lots of really interesting data. Even if you're not a software tester, I hope that you'll find something of value out of that talk, because a big part of what we're doing in 2010 is really trying to lower the barrier that exists between software developers and software testers. So once again, this talk is meant for everyone. The next talk is really focused on testing, but I also think there's something of value for developers as well. So, what everyone came here, of course, for is a bit of shameless self-promotion. My name's Brian Keller. I mentioned that. I work in Redmond. I flew about 5,000 miles to get here, and it's really great to be here. I was in Dev Days South Africa last week, so this is my third Dev Days this month, and really great turnout, so it's great to be here. I started at Microsoft about 8 years ago. I started off on J Sharp, so I had very humble beginnings, and I'm really thrilled to have been working on Visual Studio Team System, or what we now refer to as Visual Studio Application Lifecycle Management, for the past few years now. I also, you may recognize me from Channel 9, so I do a weekly podcast, or video podcast, I guess, if you will. I just realized right before I came up on stage that I'm wearing the exact same shirt, so that's kind of embarrassing. But we do a show every week. It's on Fridays. It's kind of a survey across everything that's happening in the Microsoft developer ecosystem. So if you're kind of interested in a short 20 to 30 minute podcast that touches on everything from new power tools to new patterns that are available to things that we just think are cool, hopefully you'll tune in and check us out. I also blog here, and the reason that I'm showing you my blog is that almost everything I'm going to show you today, you can actually go home and play with yourself. Before coming on my tour here, I made sure to package up a virtual hard drive. It's available in Hyper-V, Virtual PC, and Windows Virtual PC. So you can download that along with about 9 hands-on labs that you can use to actually follow through. So if you miss something that I'm showing here, or if you want to go back and kind of explore on your own terms, definitely go ahead and download that VHD, download the labs that go with it, and then that's all based on RC bits, which I'll be updating to RTM bits once I get back to Redmond. I also recently co-authored a book. This is Visual Studio, what is the title? Professional Application Lifecycle Management with Visual Studio 2010. So kind of a mouthful, but basically it covers everything I'm going to show you today. It has about 800 pages devoted to everything from software testing to getting up and running with Team Foundation Server to using the new IntelliTrace capabilities. So lots of really great content in there. I hope you'll check it out. Or if not my book, check out one of the other great books that's coming out on Visual Studio 2010. So, without further ado, let's drop into demos. I don't like to use PowerPoint a whole lot, so I hope you don't mind. I am going to spend most of my time actually working within a VM. But, as you may know, application lifecycle management with Visual Studio 2010 revolves a lot around Team Foundation Server. A lot of what I'll be showing you here today actually requires that you use Team Foundation Server. And so what I thought we'd start with is to actually start by setting up Team Foundation Server. So, how many people have set up Team Foundation Server 2005 or 2008? A couple of you. I'm sorry about that. It's a very painful experience, as my receding hairline will show you. But we've done a lot of work to simplify that in 2010. So what I thought I would show you is how easy it is to set up Team Foundation Server 2010. But rather than me showing you, what I'd really love to do is get a volunteer out of the audience who has never set up Team Foundation Server to come on up and actually do it for me. So, all right. Brave man right here. Come on up. Round of applause, everyone. So what is your name?
Barristorm.
Barristorm. Did I get that right? Okay, fantastic. And we've never met before, right?
seeing you for the very first time, right?
Fantastic. All right, and you've never set up Team Foundation Server before?
Never before.
Fantastic. Well, what we'd like to have you do is actually step right up and set up Team Foundation Server. I'm not going to help you out unless you get stuck here.
So I just start sweating.
Yep.
You start laughing.
Exactly. I'm just going to sit back and drink my water. Good. Yep.
Okay. Right, I have to accept, otherwise I can't do the next step.
Of course. Now, you didn't read any of that.
Sure.
Well, that's how we get you. So.
I know.
Okay. All right. You're cool with that. You've sold your soul. So I like you already.
I've sold it plenty of times.
Excellent. Excellent.
Is this microphone working?
Can we get this mic on?
No. Okay. I'll try to speak up then.
Oh, fantastic.
Right. Next step. I'll try to do the full installation, but first I need to know the difference. That's the foundation server, fair mm-hmm. enough. And the build servers, automate builds. Great. Two
Sounds
nice
good.
Functions. It only requires 817 MB. I like that.
I think that's a high-end estimate based on some prerequisites that we actually have already in the box. So in TFS 2010, what we're doing in the first phase is we're actually laying down the setup bit. So at this point, all it's doing is it's copying the components over to your computer. One thing you may notice here is that we're installing on Windows 7. We have a new configuration with TFS 2010 that allows you to install on a client operating system, so Windows 7 or Windows Vista. Once again, I apologize. And so what we're doing is we're basically copying everything over. This particular configuration we're going to use is called the TFS basic configuration, so remember that. You might need that later. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's nice about that is that it can use SQL Server Express, and once again, it can lay down on Windows Vista or Windows 7. The other thing that I've done here is just set up IIS, but beyond that, I haven't done any prereqs to get this up and running.
Okay, question while this is running.
Sure.
I'm a single developer, architect, everything.
Mm-hmm.
Would it work on a single machine?
Will it work on a single machine? Absolutely. In fact, everything I'll be showing you here today is being run off of a single VHD. So yes, that's part of the reason we created the TFS basic configuration was mm-hmm. to make sure that even if you don't necessarily have the corporate go-ahead to set up your own TFS in the enterprise level, you can at least set it up at your desk, take advantage of source control, take advantage of work items, take advantage of having a build server right there under your desk.
Good. Okay. Next step, configuration.
All right, go for it. So now this is the second phase of setup that you're running. This is basically you've already copied the bits over to the box, and now it's giving you a few options. You'll notice up there that one of those is upgrade. So if you want to upgrade from TFS 2005 or 2008 or from the betas as well, you would pick one of those options.
Okay, basic.
That's right.
That's the basic installation. Advanced gives me...
So the main difference here between some of these different configurations is with TFS Basic, you don't get to take advantage of the reporting capabilities or the SharePoint integration. So those are the two major features that we stripped out of Basic to make it easy for you to install on a client operating system.
Okay. Which one shall we take today?
Let's go with Basic if you're open to that.
Let's do it.
All right. So it's telling you...
Let's view the changes.
Yeah, sorry. We can't
no
do
connection.
That. Who reads the documentation anyway?
You're right.
Okay. I guess someone who's working as a single developer does that.
All we have to do is click next.
That's right. That's all you have to do. Yep.
You've got already...
It's also next.
Running?
Yep.
I know. You prepared that.
I did, yes.
That makes life a lot easier. Okay, I just go on with next. And a review of everything that's going to be installed.
Yep.
Let's go for next.
So now what it's doing is it's running a number of system checks. So in the past, with 2005 and 2008, you might have gotten halfway down setup and realized, gosh, I forgot to install something. I forgot to configure a prerequisite. Here, what we're doing is we're making sure that you don't shoot yourself in the foot.
Okay. And what are the system requirements themselves? Memory?
I believe that the memory is around 2 gigs of memory is recommended. Hard disk, as you saw, you know, depending on what prerequisites you have installed already, it's about 800 megs. But mm-hmm. but again, that's very dependent on what you already have installed.
So now we just sit back and wait.
Oh, now you got to click one more button, and that's configure.
Finally.
And then that'll launch. So this will actually take a little while. So I'm going to thank you right now and have you go ahead and take a seat.
My
and
pleasure.
Very much.
Okay.
Thank you. So, of course, I didn't know we were going to get such a great volunteer out of the audience, so I've already pre-installed TFS over on my other virtual machine. We'll go ahead and check in on that later. But basically, one of the things that you've already seen, of course, is that we've made TFS much more approachable to the single developer, to someone who has low system requirements. If you want to make sure that all you take advantage of is version control and work item tracking and build, then it's very, very easy to get started. But we've also done a lot of work at the high end to make TFS much more approachable for the enterprise. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about this because I'm sure there's probably not a ton of enterprise TFS administrators in the room, but rest assured that we've done a lot of work here. Microsoft makes heavy bets on using Team Foundation Server internally. If you take a look at Brian Harry's blog, Brian posts almost every other month talking about our dogfooding statistics. And we're talking terabytes and terabytes and terabytes of data for just the dev div instance of Team Foundation Server alone. And that's running off of a single instance for about 1,000 developers, all building Visual Studio, building the .NET framework, checking in changes all the time. So if we take a look at another thing we've done is we've introduced this new administration console. The administration console makes it really easy for you to do a lot of the tasks that traditionally you had to rely on the command line for. So if we take a look, for example, at the team project collections are a new concept that allows you to isolate all the different team projects that exist within Team Foundation Server. And that does a few things for you, probably the most important of which is that let's assume you're a consultant, for example, and you want to go work on a project, and at the end of the project, you have to leave behind that project for your customers so that they can continue working on it. Now what you can do is you can spin up TFS, you can create a new team project collection that's isolated within its own database, and then you can detach that team project collection when you're done, and they can attach that to their own Team Foundation Server instance. So in the past, it was really difficult to kind of separate an individual team project running on a server and another individual team project, but with team project collections, we get that isolation. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on here. Like I said, you can come in here and you can configure the way that SharePoint is configured. You can turn that on and off. You can set up what's called lab management, which is a capability I'll be talking about in my testing talks, set up your build server, and so on and so forth. Another thing I'll just show you quickly in slides is the way that you can really scale this up and out to support different configurations. So what we just set up here was Team Foundation Server running on a single machine, not unlike what you might do with TFS 2005 and 2008. You can also scale that up in 2005 and 2008 by putting that on multiple machines, so you can have your application tier, front-ending, a back-end data tier, and separate that across multiple machines. You can then start to take advantage of SQL Server clustering. We now have dedicated admin tools, as you just saw. And then finally, probably the biggest thing we did in terms of supporting scalability is we introduced in 2010 the ability to set up multiple Team Foundation Server application tiers. So these are the tiers that your individual client requests talk to, and then you can set these up. You can start putting that in front of a network load balancing switch. You can start taking advantage of redundancy and failover and everything that comes with having the network load balancer in front of that. And then you can also, as you see here, I've started to separate multiple databases across multiple servers as well. So you can have a team project collection on one server, a team project collection on another server, have that all be front-ended with the same friendly name for your clients to connect to. So for the rest of the demonstrations, I'm going to be dealing with a fictitious website known as Tailspin Toys. So Tailspin Toys is your basic e-commerce site. If we take a look at the application, we can drill into model airplanes, we can select an airplane, add it to our cart, remove it, go through checkout, everything you'd expect with an e-commerce application. And this, once again, is all available with the VHD that I've shipped as well. I'm going to be spending the rest of this particular talk talking about some of the new architecture tooling that we have within Visual Studio 2010. The next thing I'll focus on is the project management capabilities. So once you've decided which requirements you want to implement for your customer, in which order do you go about planning those requirements and doling them out to the team and making sure that everyone is assigned the right level of work. And then I'll be showing you some of the development capabilities that we have in store as well. So to start with, I have my project open here, my solution rather, and let's say that I'm a new developer working on this project, or maybe I worked on this project 6 months ago and I've slept since then, as my mom would say, and so I've forgotten everything that happened yesterday or that happened 6 months ago. One of the things we can do is we can now generate a dependency graph by reverse engineering your existing solution. So I can drill in based on a custom generation here, and I can say, you know, I want to see assemblies and namespaces, and maybe I want to generate some documentation. So I want to show all of the public assemblies and namespaces and methods and so on and so forth. And so this basically shows me a preview of the type of diagram that would be generated. But I'm just going to go ahead and generate a diagram based on assembly. And what this will do is it will generate a DGML diagram. So this is a standards-based diagram that you can actually use with other modeling tools to operate against this DGML. And it's reflecting against my existing .NET project to generate this dependency graph. So here you can see that it's found 2,800 nodes and 10,000 links. And if we start to drill into this, you can see that these are the various assemblies that make up my project, as well as references out to generics and externals as well. If we wanted to drill into generics, for example, you can see that it starts to expand. I can drill in. You know, at this point, I might be interested in everything that the ILIST package actually references. Well, rather than have to follow this line all the way down, one of the things I can do is just mouse over that line, click on the arrow, and that'll take me straight to the other component that it references here. So let's go ahead and collapse everything. We'll collapse all. One of the other things that you'll see in here is that you can take advantage of some of the analyzers. So we can turn these on and go out and find circular references, hubs, unreferenced nodes. Maybe there's code that's stale within this project that I might want to clean up. We give you a lot of tools to really help you be a code archaeologist, if you will, and help you understand your existing code so that you can then begin to refactor it and understand it before you start making changes. The next thing you'll notice here is that if I expand externals, this shows me all of the external references for which I don't have the source control within my solution. So you can see down here we have systemdll, mscorelib. Maybe I'm not interested in actually referencing these in my diagram, and so, you know, of course, every project's going to use some of these, so I can go ahead and delete these. I can delete systemdll. Of course, this isn't actually deleting the DLLs from my system. That would be silly. But it is deleting them from my diagram. And so we can start to make some sense of this. And this might actually become your documentation. I know everyone in here has up-to-date documentation all the time, but if you're like me, you may not. And so this is one of the ways that you can kind of get that documentation. Another thing you'll notice here is that these lines from my solution actually stop at the externals barrier. And so that's really by design to reduce noise, so you're not looking at this diagram that has all these crisscrosses all over the place. But let's say that I actually was interested in understanding how these solution assemblies actually relate to the external assemblies. What I can do is I can say group and remove group, and now what it does is it collapses everything into one big spaghetti diagram. So I can then drill in, see that, oops. Can see that everything's being referenced. Now, the other thing to notice is that the strength of these lines actually has meaning as well. So the thicker lines represent a greater dependency between one assembly and the next, and the thinner lines, of course, mean you have fewer dependencies. But the problem with what I just did is I just lost a level of detail. So now it's impossible for me to tell at a glance exactly which assemblies are external and which assemblies are internal to my project. And so one of the things I can do is I can come to this legend. I can say add a node property is external, set the background color, true, we'll make it red, and now all of my external assemblies are red. It's pretty cool, huh? Another thing that we've done around architecture is we've created what's called the Architecture Explorer. And so if I come down to Windows and Architecture Explorer, Architecture Explorer gives me a nice way of actually drilling into my project either by the class view or by the solution view. And so to give you a sense for what that looks like, if I start with class view, I can drill across and I can say, okay, I've got my tailspin.admin.app. Let's look at that particular namespace, and then let's take a look at the product relationship types. And so product relationship types, or rather has three members. One of those might be product. And on product, we have get product and set product. So I might be interested in get product. Now, you can notice that across the bottom, we have a number of different verbs or ways of referencing one box to the next. And so here, get product actually doesn't call anything. But maybe instead, I'm interested in seeing what calls get product. And so if we scroll down, we can say all inbound links, And you can see product calls get product. And of course, that's starting to get a little bit recursive. But what we can do is we can generate another DGML graph from this. And then this will show me exactly what I just drilled in through. So everything I did, which was just remembered as I went from left to right, drilling in via the class view. And then this can also become something that I might use just to understand the project, understand the way that product relationship calls product. Maybe it becomes documentation. I can even come down here to set product, drag this up onto my diagram. And now you can see how that's related as well. Maybe Tailspin Toys is a solution. I don't need to represent that. And then here we have a nice little piece of documentation that I can then use to explain the way that product has get product and set product. Of course, I can print that to PDF or XPS or whatever I'd like. Another thing we've done around software architecture is we've implemented UML diagrams. So you no longer have to use Visio and go external to Visual Studio in order to work with UML. We've implemented 5 UML-compliant diagrams. I think it's UML 2.1.1. And if we take a look at some of the diagrams that we have, one is the logical diagram. So I'm not going to bore you by going into all the details of UML for this talk. I just want to show you and make you aware that these diagrams do exist. Another one might be the use case diagram. And so if we take a look at the use case diagram, one of the cool things that you can do with this is that it's not just a pretty picture. It's not just a way of representing your use case diagrams. I mean, let's face it, you can do that on your whiteboard. You can do that in MS Paint. But one of the things that you might want to do is actually reference a work item from here. So let's say that I updated this diagram and I added a new activity that I wanted to be modeled within my project, and I then wanted to assign that to a developer to go implement that. What I can do is I can get my diagram into the state that I'd like it to be in, then create a work item that's linked off of one of the nodes within these diagrams, assign it to a developer. The developer then picks it up, and they don't just see this one-line description saying, we want you to add the ability for the user to pay with a credit card. Instead, they can then use that, link it back to any of the relevant UML diagrams, and they get a much better understanding of what you had in mind when you wanted them to implement this functionality. So the 5 diagrams we implement are the activity, use case, class, sequence, and component, which I always forget, so I always have to write it down. You can expect us to deliver more diagrams in the future as well. Another nice thing about the way we've implemented the sequence diagram is you can actually create a sequence diagram by reverse engineering from existing code. So if I open up my Tailspin web project, let's say that I've been asked to make some changes to the way that remove item works. So I come down to my card actions. Remember, I didn't write this code, or maybe I wrote it 6 months ago, and it's been a while since I've looked at it. You know, what's the first thing you might do in terms of trying to understand the way remove item works? Well, if you're like me, you might F5 the solution. You might start setting some breakpoints. You might go to definition. You might try to just, you know, skip all over the code to try and understand exactly what's going on. Well, wouldn't it be nice if we could actually get all that information at our fingertips? Well, now you can. You just right-click on the method and say generate a sequence diagram. This will give you a few options for how deep do you want this sequence diagram to go, for example. Say OK, that's going to go out, it's going to reverse engineer, and there's our sequence diagram. So just like I described with the earlier diagram and the use case diagram, the other thing I could do here as an architect or as a development lead is I could come into this diagram and I could make some changes to this diagram. I could save that out, store it along with a work item, and then explain to the developer implementing this code, when I want you to go change these this particular pattern, I want you to follow the diagram and understand exactly what needs to be updated. Now, in terms of architecture, I've saved my favorite for last, and that is the layer diagram. So the layer diagram, I'm sure we've all drawn these out on whiteboards before. If I open up the layer diagram, you know, architecturally, it's not a new concept. We say, okay, you know, this is an ASP.NET MVC application, so, you know, we're going to have our controllers here, and the controller is going to call down into model, and model is going to call into the infrastructure, and we're going to have a presentation layer, and yada, yada, yada. So, you know, that's a layer diagram, fancy way of drawing that out in Visual Studio. But what makes it really unique is the fact that I can actually map the individual classes and namespaces that make up my solution back to the layer that they should be in. So if I right-click on this and say, view the links over to the right, you can see that for controllers, we have these 4 different classes. And the way that I generated this to start with is I, used the toolbox, drag and drop some shapes onto the design surface, and then I went to my solution view, drag and drop those objects onto the shapes that they should actually be contained within. And so you may be saying, well, okay, that's great. What are we going to do with that? Well, now what I can do is I can right-click and I can say validate architecture. And once again, this is going to reflect against my existing solution, and it's going to come back and tell me whether or not my existing architecture matches what I've modeled within my layer diagram. And sure enough, it doesn't. So down here, you can see that we have a number of different references that exist within this project, which actually violate that layer diagram. So if I double-click on one of those errors, you can see that it takes me straight to the line of code. I'm not going to spend a lot of time delving into this because let's say that, when I was modeling this, in reality, maybe I didn't draw the model correctly. And I know that my solution is in a pristine state. We've done code reviews. We've represented this the way that I architected it. But it just so happens that maybe I created my layer diagram incorrectly. Well, once you get close enough, once you have the components mapped to the structures that they should be contained within, you can then right-click and say generate dependencies. And that's going to do the reverse. It's going to say, based on my existing solution, let's go ahead and reverse engineer that and update any of the references so that, for example, what you can see here is that we now have two bidirectional assemblies or bidirectional dependencies that we've detected. So up here at the top, what we did, for those of you sitting in the front and notice that, we actually created bidirectional references between helpers and DI and MVC, as well as controllers. So now that's updated the layer diagram for me. I can then save that back to Team Foundation Server, and that becomes the model that we want the developers to follow. And what becomes really important about this is if you think about using this within a software engineering context, I want to make sure that my project no longer strays from what I've modeled as an architect. How many architects do we have in the room, or people who play the role of architects? I know that my friend here does. And so, how many times have you created a diagram and you've handed it out to your team, and your team says, great, looks good, they hang it on the side of their cubicle, and they never look at it again? Well, that happens all the time, right? And so what we want to do with this diagram is actually allow you to make it a build verification test. So when I F5 my code, you can actually say that you want to run this diagram and generate warnings or generate errors if they've added any code that doesn't conform to this. You can even make it part of your team build environment as well. And what you'll see me show later is the new gated check-in capability that we have that prevents anyone on your team from ever breaking the build again. So I'll show you that later on, but basically just keep in mind that the layer diagram can be a part of that build process so that if someone does make a change that has an illegal dependency reference and they try to check that in, it kicks it back to them and says, actually, you can't make that change until you fix the dependency. So that's everything for architecture. Now let's kind of fast forward and say, we understand this project. We're ready to hit the ground running. We've got a customer that's coming to us and saying, all right, these are the requirements that we want you to go implement. So now what? Putting my project manager hat on or my developer lead hat on and trying to figure out which requirements we're going to implement now, which ones we're going to have to put off later, and who's actually going to do the work. And so if we come back over to Team Explorer and take a look at my existing work items. Let's take a look at the product planning backlog. So product planning basically gives me a list of all the different requirements or user stories, or you may have different terminology, but basically think about this as the things your customer wants you to do in terms of building your application out. And so if I take a look at this particular list, we can see there's a long list of requirements. I'm sure they're great. The customer gave them to us, so we need to go figure out how we're going to go implement these. You can see that we've assigned some story points to them, so if you practice Agile or if you practice Scrum, this may sound familiar. Other development methodologies may use similar terms or things that mean the same thing. Basically, you can think of these as rough orders of magnitude. Some development methodologies use t-shirt sizes. The idea is that at this point, we're kind of putting our thumb in the air and saying, okay, I think that this is going to take us 5 man days to implement, or 3 man days, or hours, or whatever you think the case may be. So how do we start to break this down? Well, one of the things we've done in 2010 is we've started to give you these planning workbooks that allow you to start to work with some of this data in Excel in a much richer manner. So some of the capabilities that you'll see here were actually available in 2005 and 2008, but you'll see what sets this apart if you're familiar with using it in those versions of the product. So here I've opened up this backlog within Excel. You can see here that I have the exact same data represented in here. One of the first things that I'll do is I'll actually come down to my iterations tab, and I'll define what I want my iteration to look like. So I believe that next week, help me out here, Monday is the 5th, is that correct? And that goes through the 10th, so that's 5 days, so that's good enough for me. And we have a team size of 3 that's working on this. And so what you can see here is that I've modeled what my iteration looks like. I'll be working from Monday to Friday of next week, and I've got a team size of 3. And so we can start to also look back historically and say, well, based on the last time I had a project that lasted 5 days and I had a team size of 3, I was able to plan 11 units of work, and I was able to deliver 3 units of work. So let's say I'm actually in the middle of that iteration, and I think that I'm on track to actually deliver a total of 14 units of work. Maybe that's hours, maybe that's days. Once again, we allow you to set that metric. So I want to basically bite off the same amount of work for this next iteration. So I'm planning iteration 3. So if we come into here, we can see that we can just start adding items off the backlog. This has already been stack ranked by the customer. So we've added 3 items to iteration 3. Looks like we still have a little bit more capacity. If we add this up, then we've allocated 10 units of work, and we said that we wanted to plan 14. So we'll take on an extra 4 items of work, come back to our backlog. And if you look at the story points over here, it looks like the next item on this on the backlog is actually has a weight of 9 story points. So 9, 7, well, there's 1 of 4. That actually looks like it's pretty good. So we'll skip a couple of story points and or user stories and go ahead and pick that one up. And so now what we've done is we've said, okay, we think based on just these rough order of magnitude calculations and based on yesterday's weather, so what our team was able to do in the previous iteration, we think we'll be able to take on this much work. So we'll go ahead and publish this back to Team Foundation Server, and then go on to the next phase, which is actually breaking this down and assigning it to individual team members. And so in 2005 and 2008, this is kind of where our product functionality dropped off a cliff and said, okay, you're kind of on your own for figuring out what individuals do and how much work is assigned to an individual or to a team and whether or not those team members are going to be on vacation or whatnot. And so one of the things that we've done within 2010 is we've also built an agile planning tool to help you plan an iteration. And the other foundational thing we've done within TFS is we've implemented hierarchical work items within TFS. So we no longer have the restriction of just having this flat list of work items with these rudimentary links that exist between work items. Now what we have instead is a rich hierarchy. So you can represent parent-child relationships. So let's say that you had a user story or requirement and you wanted to represent all the individual children tasks that have to go into implementing that requirement. You can do that now. Let's say that you want to draw a relationship between your individual test cases and what requirements they test. And so we now have the tests tested by relationship. You can also create your own relationship if you don't like the ones that we support out of the box. And I'll show you in a minute how successor and predecessor can be used in conjunction with Microsoft Project as well to help you plan exactly when the work's going to take place, even within a given iteration. And so to start with, let's open up our iteration 3 backlog. You can see this is just another Excel spreadsheet that we'll open up. And so these all ship with the product. And if I refresh this data, you can see that what we've done is we've actually pulled in those 4 user stories that we picked off the backlog in the previous step. And so you can see that a few of these actually have children tasks already. So if you take a look, for example, at as a store administrator, I should be able to track all open orders. So we've already gone to the step of breaking this down into the individual children tasks that we think are going to be required to implement this user story. So we see we need to create a database view, we need to implement a web front end, and then we need to design that web front end. Maybe not in that order, but those are the 3 things that we need to do in order to make this requirement a reality. But you can see down here that I have another requirement that hasn't actually been fleshed out. So I might want to go ahead and add the individual tasks that I think make up that requirement. Well, that's easy enough to do within Excel or within Visual Studio. What I'll do is I'll just go ahead and add child. You can see that it adds three new rows to this workbook. And if we come back and cheat a little bit, so you don't have to watch me type. And I'll basically just paste that into place, and you can see that I've created three child tasks. Each one of these is already assigned to an individual team member just based on who I think might be able to take on this work. We don't know for sure yet. As we move over to the right, you can see that this is the amount of work each one is going to take, and then these have been assigned to iteration three. So I'll just go ahead and assign the rest of the tasks in this workbook to iteration three as well, and we'll go ahead and publish because we've done some work to actually flesh out that user story. But we still haven't answered the question of, okay, we think we're going to take on this work. Can we actually bite that off in the time that we have? So once again, I'll define the iteration time frame. That's going to take 5 days. And then if we come to the capacity tab, you can start to see the team capacity. I'll assign the individual team members that are working on this. So we have these three team members. And they're each going to work for 5 hours a day. And you can see here that we immediately get a graph that shows us just how much work each person has been assigned. So you can see that Abu has plenty of capacity. Doris, she's kind of about half capacity. But April, she's kind of maxed out. So if she ends up having some delays, she's kind of at risk of dragging this project down. So what we might say is, all right, well, Abu seems to have a lot of spare capacity. We know that Abu does a lot of the same type of work that April does. So he's going to offer to April, you know what, I'm going to take one of those items off the backlog. Let's take a look here and see, okay, we've got this one's pretty big, implementing the web front end for viewing all open orders. So we'll go ahead and assign that to Abu. Come back to my capacity tab. That automatically gets updated. But now, of course, because April doesn't have as much work to do, she says, you know, next week would be pretty nice to take a vacation. You know, it's already a 4-day work week. Let's take a couple more days in there as well. So if we come to the interruptions tab, we can say April is going on vacation. And that's going to be the 5th and the 6th. And oh, by the way, Monday is Easter Monday. And that's happening on the 5th. Come back to capacity. We see that April's overloaded. Well, I've already done some work to figure out that the rest of the team members don't know how to do some of the tasks that are assigned to April. So maybe you want to come down here. And you know, we were pretty ambitious with taking on this additional work item. So let's go ahead and push that back onto the back onto the backlog. We can always address it next time. Come back to capacity. Everything looks happy. April gets to go on her vacation. So as you can see here, this is just a really quick and dirty way of going out and planning your sprints or your iterations or whatever you'd like to call them. One of the nice things here is that because it's all based on Excel, if you want to modify this to your heart's content and add additional functionality, you can do that. One of the things that that I've seen people within Microsoft do is actually add in a calculation based on incoming bug rates. So it's all fine and good to say that, you know, in iteration one, we're going to do a bunch of work, but then we get to iteration two, and we have to account for the incoming bugs that are coming off of the work that we checked into iteration one. And so maybe we can pull some data from TFS to help say that, you know, April did a lot of work last iteration, but she has about 30% of her time. We want her to focus on actually fixing bugs. So there's a number of different things that you can do just in terms of adding that capability to the spreadsheet. Another thing that I've seen people start to work on as well is a capability matrix. So you can start to add hints to the system that say, well, we know that Abu is really good at ASP.NET development, but if you try to have him write, you know, a SQL task, he's probably not going to do very well at that. So you can start to break down your work. Maybe you want to break that down based on the areas that exist within Team Foundation Server. Once again, it's all in Excel, so you can examine our formulas and modify those to your heart's content. So that's Excel. What if I want to work with the same data within Visual Studio? Well, of course, we wanted to make that a great surface for you to work in as well. And so if I open up the same data within a query, come back to iteration three, you can see that, of course, you don't get quite as nice of an experience as you do within Excel, which is really great for doing batch edits, but I can still do things that you might not expect. So I can come in here and drag and drop this task. Maybe it's actually supposed to be represented as part of that user story. I can take this particular subtask and maybe indent that an extra level. So that becomes a grandchild of this particular user story. I can right-click here and say, create a new linked work item. And that gives me the form to say, OK, you want to create a new work item. What's the relationship that you want to create? Well, I want to create a child relationship or successor, predecessor, test, tested by. Any of these relationships are really easy to work with. But you can notice here that everything's actually bolded at this point because we haven't persisted any of these changes back to TFS. And so I'll just refresh and say, no, that I'd like to go ahead and abandon these changes. I also promised that I would show you how you can work with Microsoft Project. If I select these work items and say open in Microsoft Project, then it will get a similar list of work items that are once again broken down by parent-child, and we also recognize the successor and predecessor relationships as well. In previous versions of TFS, the problem was that we didn't, of course, understand the parent-child relationships, nor do we understand the successor-predecessor, so you'd have to maintain this project plan separately as another artifact outside of TFS. Now, because we support the same type of rich hierarchical work item information, we can actually share that information back and forth. So, for example, if I come into this particular set of work items, we already said that, you know, maybe designing the web front end should really come before implementing the web front end. Call me crazy. But let's go ahead and say that, you know, implementing the front end has a dependency on this particular work item. And it's a small task, but you can see that that's actually added sort of a predecessor relationship in here. And if we now publish this and come back to work item 33 within TFS and take a look at my links tab, then you can see there's a predecessor pointing back to task 34. One last thing related to project management, and that is reporting. So reporting is really, I think, the holy grail of getting the most benefit out of Team Foundation Server. One of the reasons that we implemented Team Foundation Server the way we did, starting with TFS 2005, is that we wanted to not just give you a great source control solution, not just give you a great build environment, not just give you a great work tracking system, but really create something that was more than the sum of its parts. So, for example, you can check in source control, and then you can link that to the individual work that it represents. And so what that means is that if I'm looking at a file, and I'm trying to understand why Frank just made changes to this file, we can then take a look at the work that he's linked behind that, and we can understand that, oh, okay, it was to actually fix that bug. And so off of that, we can start to generate lots of really interesting reports. I'll show you a few of the ones that we ship within TFS 2010 out of the box, but you're always going to have additional questions that you want to answer about how you might be able to better steer your projects. And the pain in the past has been that if you wanted to create your own custom reports, you had to first understand the cube that you're writing those reports against, and then you had to go out and either modify an existing report using SQL reporting services or create one from scratch. And I'll be the first to admit, even our own engineers internally, when they go to create one of these new reports, and that's their full-time job is creating these reports, it usually takes them about a week to create one of these reports. And so by then you're like, well, is it really worth me creating all that additional data? What's the ROI? Is it worth me making that investment? And so we wanted to make sure that you're doing all this work to get data into TFS. Let's help you get that data out of TFS very easily. So one hypothetical report I want to create here is let's see all of the work that's currently assigned to my team. Okay, so you may have multiple teams working within TFS. I'm mainly interested in the work that my immediate direct reports are working on. And so one way to do that is you actually can create a custom query first. So we'll add a new query, and we'll just start adding assigned to, and we'll say Abu, we know he's on our team, or assigned to April, she's on our team. I won't do it for everybody, but let's get one more person in here. We know that we want to track Doris as well. So at this point, I can just go ahead and group this clause, run this query, Now this is going to come back with a list of all the work items that are currently assigned to my team. And that's nice. It's nice to get a nice little list. We can save this off as a query if we wanted to. But let's say that we wanted to look at this graphically and take a look at things like, okay, over time, how is this data actually changing and moving through through my team? And how much work is currently assigned to my team and is active and is focused on the website as opposed to the database tier? So now what you can do is you can select this query down here, select this data. We'll create a report in Microsoft Excel. Now it's going to look back and analyze this query, and it's going to give me a list of reports that I can choose to build. So here we have two different types of reports. At the top level, we have current reports, and we have trend reports. Current reports, of course, are a snapshot in time. Trend reports show me things that happened over the lifespan of the data we're looking at. And so we'll go ahead and generate this. 30 seconds later, we should have some great reports. And here we do. So we can see that we've got work items by type. And you can see that I've got bugs, tasks, test cases, who's the work actually assigned to. So this can help me make sure that the work's not overloading an individual team member. Work item state by count, and so on and so forth. Here you can start to see trends. I mean, if you've tried to do this in the past, it probably would have taken you days, if not weeks, to actually put together some of these reports. And we've just done it in a few seconds here. Another thing I can do is I can then start customizing. So let's say that we want to look at work items by state and then drill down. We've done a lot of work to actually simplify the cube. So these are, we think, pretty English-friendly names. And if we take a look at the different areas I can choose from, let's say that I want to look at area path. And so now what we've done is we've added that to our pivot chart. We can now see, based on the business logic, based on the database, based on the website, how does this work actually break down, and then how is it assigned to my team. If you have Microsoft Office SharePoint Server, you can take advantage of SharePoint services, or I'm sorry, Excel services from here, and you can then say publish, and you can say Excel services. I don't have it wired up at this point, but really if you wanted to, you could just publish this to a SharePoint endpoint, and then that can be represented within a Moss dashboard, so you can create a custom view for your CIO that shows him exactly how great your team's doing every single day. So really, really easy stuff to create, and that's just one quick example. Speaking of dashboards, we have really done a lot of work to improve the team project portal on this release. So if we take a look at the project portal here, this is based on WSS. You can also take advantage of Moss, as I mentioned. We have a lot of flexibility in the setup now. You can take advantage of existing SharePoint farms. If you have existing SharePoint farms within your organization, maybe you want to do that. Just point TFS so that anytime you create a new team project, it can create your workspace or your project portal over there. And now this starts to show you some of the reports that we ship out of the box. It's a little bit slow the first time it loads. You see that down here we can see all the different product backlog items that exist within this particular project. We can take a look, for example, at the team wiki. So one of the things that we found is that a lot of teams go out and create their own wikis to talk about processes or how should you close bugs. So we wanted to make that available to you, so now you can take advantage of the wiki there. So you can see that I don't have a lot of really interesting data in here, but as you start to create burndowns and move through your project, you can start to watch that grow over time, or actually shrink over time, I would hope, as your tasks start to disappear. We also had a power tool within the last release called Team System Web Access. And so that was a separate tool that you could install to give people that just wanted to use a web browser access to pretty much all the functionality that you would need to access within Team Foundation Server. And so we've now rolled that into the default installation for TFS now. So if I open up Team Web Access, that's going to give me a really nice way to work with work items, to look at the different builds that exist within my system, and to even get a read-only view into source control as well. So here you can see I've got my own dashboard, work items here. I can select different projects that might be within my TFS server. Take a look at team queries. If we go back to the same information, iteration backlog, you can see that I get the exact same hierarchy represented within here as well. And there's source control. and build. While I'm here, the other thing I'll mention is that in October, we acquired a company called TeamPrize. TeamPrize, for several years, ever since we shipped Team Foundation Server, they have been providing the Team Explorer functionality that you find within Visual Studio. They've been re-implementing that within J2SE. So you can really run that capability on any machine that supports Java and then connect back to Team Foundation Server for completing your work. One of the even better things they did is they took that functionality and they implemented that to integrate with Eclipse. And so we've taken over that company and we've hired all their top talent over to continue to work on that and continue to make sure that we provide that great functionality, and that will actually sim ship with Team Foundation Server here in a few weeks. So I promised I would show you a few of the reports here, and I've got way more reports than we have time to show. So some of this is basically just in here for your reference if you want to go download my slide deck and take a look at some of these other materials. But I will talk about some of the reports that you do get out of the box with TFS, because really, once you start lighting up some of these capabilities, once again, this can be really valuable data to help you steer your project. As you look across here, one of the things you'll notice is that along the left-hand side, we have my different user stories. And so, again, at the top level, we're giving a really nice way for you to track exactly which user stories were on track or maybe not on track to deliver back to the customer. And so if you move from left to right, we have hours completed. So that shows how much of the development work has actually been done. Hours remaining, that's, of course, important. We have any tests that have been written against this. So you can see that a few of my user stories might benefit from having some additional tests written. You can see that we have test results. So that's the green is passed. Of course, green's always good. Red's failed. And then black means that we haven't actually run those tests. And then we have the number of bugs that are filed against those user stories. So if you're a external customer or a stakeholder, or maybe you're a CIO, someone who's not actively involved in the day-to-day project, and you just want to see at a glance exactly how a project's going, this is one great report that's really useful for doing that. I should mention, actually, a lot of people don't know this, that Windows 7 and Office 2010 were actually built using the work item hierarchy that exists now in Team Foundation Server 2010. So when we sat down with the Windows team and the Office teams in between Vista and Windows 7 and in between the last release of Office and what they're working on now, we really wanted to deliver something that they could use internally, and they said this is the number one thing that they would adopt out of Team Foundation Server would be if you can give us this rich way of representing what we want to deliver to the customer, how we're going to deliver it to them, and how we're going to make sure that it's well tested, then that's something that we can use to track throughout the entire process. And so if you like Windows 7, you're welcome. I like to take credit for that. But honestly, truly, this is stuff that's been tested and been implemented for the last 2-3 years, and so it's something that we're excited to deliver within TFS 2010. Here's another look at what you get if you actually light up your dashboard to take advantage of one of the Moss dashboards. One of the things that's hard to tell right across the side is that we have a variety of different views into this depending on your perspective into the project. So you can see we've got burn down, quality, bugs, test, build. So depending on what your role is or depending on what aspect of the project you might be interested in, you can see a number of different dashboards which help you understand exactly what's going on across the project. So I know that's kind of hard to read in the back, but we have bug progress, we have 7-day bug trend rates, active bugs by priority, active bugs by assignment. Here's another one, code coverage and code churn. This, of course, shows how much of my code is being changed from build to build, as well as code coverage, which shows how much of my code is actually being tested. And so as you get towards the end of the release and your tests start to get implemented, hopefully you are driving those code coverage rates up higher and higher. Work burn down, so hopefully your burn downs look like that, otherwise you're in trouble. You can see once again, here's how I can access all my individual tasks, my team's bugs, test plan. So one of the things that you'll see in my testing talks is that test cases are actually a first-class work item now within Team Foundation Server. And what that means, among other things, is that they get to benefit from this rich relationship that exists between work items. So you've heard me mention a few times how much of my how many tests are passing or failing for an individual requirement. Well, one of the really nice things you can do now, of course, is author those test cases to map back to those user stories or requirements. This shows you a list of how your builds are doing over time. It's probably worth mentioning that that one of the capabilities a lot of teams use now is continuous integration, or I'll show you gated check-in. One of the great things about continuous integration is that you build early and often, maybe as often as every single check-in, to try and determine whether or not some change that got checked in actually broke the build. Well, that's really great for quickly telling you whether or not something's been checked in that you need to go back out. But what about actually tracking a solid day-to-day or maybe a morning-to-night build pattern? So as you start thinking about setting up your build environments, you might want to have a continuous integration build, but you might also want to have daily builds as well, which allow you to kind of hang all of your reports off of exactly what's going on. So you need to think about that as you start doing your build planning. And then here's just another report that shows you some builds. Burn down. This is reactivations. So reactivations are an interesting way of looking at bugs as they move through the system. So within our default MSF for Agile template, we have three states for bugs. A bug starts out active, and then a developer supposedly fixes it and pushes it to resolved. The tester then looks at that and says, actually, yes, that bug was resolved, so we push it to closed. Or the tester says, actually, no, this bug still exists, and they push it back to active. And so you can see here that we have a relatively low reactivation rate across the system. But if we started to have this creep up into higher levels of red, then that might be an indicator that the developers are doing sloppy coding practices, or that maybe there's a communication barrier that exists between the testing team and the development team. You know, I had a really great meeting yesterday with one of the local companies here, and they were asking, how do we use the metrics that exist within Team Foundation Server to help measure performance and productivity of individual members of a team? And I had to stop them and say, you know, you have to be really careful with some of this data. What do they say in Spider-Man? You know, you need to make sure your powers are used for good and not evil, right? And so this can be something that you have to kind of halt yourself and say, okay, you know, are we really looking at the number of bugs that a tester is filing, or are we looking at the quality of those bugs that the tester is filing? So I would say that there's a lot of data in here. There's a lot of different perspectives you can look at, but don't take any one data point to make a decision. And that's part of why we have all these different dimensions that exist across the different ways of showing you how your project is progressing or any impediments that might exist within the system. And that is to make sure that you're not just looking at an individual data point that exists in here. And then a few other, it was like how your individual test plan is progressing, which tests have been implemented, which tests have not, which tests are still in design. Once again, I'll show a little bit more of that in my next talk. So that is project management, and next I'm going to show you some of the new development capabilities that we have. And so if we take a look at the website that we launched earlier, fancy new website. We just launched it, we're selling lots of planes, but we're also getting a lot of customer complaints as well. So customers call us up and they say, you know what, some of these links don't actually work. And sure enough, we take a look at the bottom down here. We've got investor relations, store locations, order status. So it looks like we had all the best intents in mind when we created this page, but in reality, we actually never implemented some of these links. And so we don't want to confuse customers, and so we actually want to go ahead and make this change to the production website. Well, if you're like most web development organizations, you probably have a branching structure that looks something like this, where you have your release branch down here, and this represents what you just pushed out to production. And then you have an iteration branch that exists up here, and that maybe is what your developers are currently working on during the course of day-to-day changes and upgrades that they're making to the site. But these changes haven't actually been tested yet, so we're not ready to push them out to the website. Well, for this particular change, we don't have time to make the change in the iteration 2 branch, wait for the testers to go out and test that, and then wait for the engineers to go out and deploy that. Let's say that that's happening next Friday, assuming nothing gets delayed. Well, we've got customers calling up now with this problem, so we really want to fast-track this change into production. So if I open up my production branch and come into the website here, I happen to know that that change is represented on this template.master page. So if we scroll down, we can take these links and we can comment them out. The about page actually works, but everything else is broken. So we're going to go ahead and make that change. Before I do that, let me just back out some of my other pending changes. Okay, so we've made that change, save the file, and we're going to go ahead and check this in with the solution. Now, at this point, I'm going to give it a check-in comment that actually makes sense based on the change we just made. And there's a reason that I'm calling that out. And so we're removing the bottom nav links that don't work. And we'll check that in. Great, that's been checked into the production branch. And let's fast forward and say that we go ahead and create a build off of this, and we push this to the production website, and that change is gone. So that's great, but now the problem is that a week from now, when the development team finishes making their changes to iteration 2, they're going to create a build based on the branch which doesn't have this change. They're going to push that out to production, and we're going to have the exact same problem again. So what we need to do is we need to take those changes we just fast-tracked into production, and we need to push those back into the iteration 2 branch. But how do we do that? Let's say we've got a complex branching structure. We don't understand how the production 2 branch actually relates to the iteration 2 branch, and so that's where TFS 2010 introduces a number of capabilities to help you answer that problem. And so to start with, if we go ahead and visualize this branch, And one thing I should point out here is, if you haven't already noticed, the branches are actually represented by a different icon than the individual folders. And so if you have an individual folder that you want to create a branch from, or rather tell TFS that this is my branch, you can simply right-click on a folder, and you can say convert to branch. And doing so actually gives you a number of different properties that weren't there before. And so you can get a description, so you can say, you know, only make production changes here. You can see who owns this branch, so I should actually be talking to Abu before I make any changes in here. You can see permissions, so you get really granular NTFS-style permissions over who's allowed to check in and out of this branch, and so on and so forth. But I need to understand how this branch actually relates to the other branches that exist in my system. So I can view hierarchy, and this is going to show me that production 1 branch is actually a child of main. So that's the first step. That tells me how production 1 is related to main, but I still have no idea how to get back to iteration 2. And so what I can do is I can create a view that shows me now all the branches that exist in my system, and we can see that we have a very simple integration branch scenario in here. So main is an integration branch. If I want to make changes to production 1, if I want to make changes to iteration 2, I'll merge those changes back into main and then have those flow back into iteration 2. So let's go ahead and do that. If I view history, you can see here's my change set. That was removing the bottom links that don't work. If I right-click, we get a new option to say track change set. If we open up track change set, it says which branches are you interested in. Well, iteration 1, that's long gone. I don't care about maintaining that. But production 1 and iteration 2, that's where I want to make my changes. And actually, it looks like I did this in reverse. I didn't open up the correct solution, but that's not a problem. So let's say that I made my changes over in iteration 2, and I want to move that to production 1. So you can see here that green, of course, remember, green is good. So my change is actually already introduced into iteration 2. And if I drag and drop that onto main, then it opens up the merge wizard, and it already knows this is my target. I want to move that into main. Next, next, next. And what that does is it now pins my changes. And because I went from iteration 2 over to production as opposed to the other way around, I've got some other stuff happening down here. Just ignore that. And so let's say moving changes from website into main. So I'm intentionally being a little bit sloppy with my check-in comments. You'll see why. Refresh this diagram. Now you can see we're green on main. That's a new change set that was introduced. Let's keep moving through here. Moved changes from main to production. Check that in. Refresh the diagram. So, okay, everything's green. Everything's good, right? But what happens when someone else comes and now takes a look at the branch that they were doing all of their work in, and they try to understand what were those changes that were just made? Well, in the past, with TFS 2005 or 2008, the only information you would get was that you had a change that merged through the integration branch and into the branch that you were working in. And you wouldn't get any information about the origin of intent, whether that was a check-in comment that said, hey, we're making this change to remove those bottom links. None of that information would actually carry over. We've done a lot of work now to help with that problem and help make sure that if you're looking at the changes that exist in the new branch, you can actually determine what changes are relevant. So if we take a look now at Source Control Explorer, let's go back, take a look at View History. You can see here, once again, we have this useless comment, move changes from main to production. Well, that doesn't tell me anything. If we open that up, we can see that the cart controller was changed. Okay, so that's starting to tell me which files were changed, but why were they changed and who changed them? Well, if we come down to website and controllers, cart controller, we can take advantage of the annotate capability, which is actually in TFS 2008. But one of the things we've done is we've enhanced that to, whoops, that's not what I wanted to do. It wasn't cart controller, it was template.master. Oh, I may have shot myself in the foot by going the wrong direction, didn't I? You guys in the front row are supposed to keep me honest here. Okay, production one. Well, you might have to take my word for it because I went in the wrong direction because I wasn't paying attention. But basically, if you were to take a look now at annotate and look at the sidebar, which shows you on a line-by-line basis who the person was that last changed an individual line, then instead of showing you that the changes were actually merged from main or merged from any given branch, they'll actually go back to the original place that that change set was introduced, and they would say this particular set of lines was commented out because we wanted to remove those bottom links. So again, we want to help everyone on the team understand what your branches and merges look like and exactly what impact those have on the team. The last thing we can do here is we can actually go to timeline tracking view. And you know, this is a very simple scenario, but you can see here exactly in which order changes were introduced in the system. And one way you might use this is, let's say you have a customer calling you on a Friday, and they say, hey, you know, we just deployed the web application that you sent to us on Thursday. Are there any bugs we should be aware of? And you can look back here and say, well, there was this really critical bug. Let me see if it actually made it into the build that you were working on. And sure enough, you can see that the build, that the bug fix for that particular problem was introduced on Wednesday night. So if they're using Thursday's build, then they should be happy. And so you can start to resolve questions like that and make sure that changes were fixed in the order that you would expect them to. So that is branching and merging. The one last thing that I'll show you, and then I think we'll turn it over for questions, is gated check-in. So if you set up builds within TFS 2005 or 2008, then some of this will seem familiar. If not, not a problem. We'll just create a new build definition. And we'll call it tailspin, not a problem. One of the things we've done in 2008 is we've introduced different trigger types. So in 2005, you really had a choice of either building manually or building on some sort of schedule. Well, we recognize that a lot of people want to take advantage of continuous integration. As I mentioned earlier, build my changes early and often. If I check in a change and that actually is a change that's going to break my build, let's get a quick notification of that I just broke the build. But that has its own problems in and of itself. So let's say that you've got 30 developers on your team, and every one of those developers only breaks the build once per month. I know no one in this room ever breaks the build, but the people who are back at your companies right now are probably breaking the build, right? So we want to make sure that they can never break the build again, because if you think about it, if you have 30 developers and each one of them breaks the build only once per month, then your build's broken pretty much every single day. And that results in lost productivity. It means that you have to go out and have people dedicated to fixing the build all the time. You can have pile-on changes that come out as a result when you know, I check in a change and that breaks the build and someone else gets my changes and now they basically have to fix whatever's in their workspace or wait for me to fix it and then check it out again, and it's a mess, right? And so we've had this problem at Microsoft for years. And one of the ways that we've really tried to solve that problem, and what works very well for us, is what's called gauntlet check-ins. That's what we call it internally, is gauntlet check-ins. And the idea is that prior to my changes actually being committed to the source control tree, prior to those becoming available for everybody else, we want to make sure that we compile the software, maybe we need to make sure that it compiles on x86 and x64, so we'll compile it twice. We need to make sure that it passes any given unit tests or other integration tests, and only after it has passed all those individual tests that we've defined do we then finally commit it into the source control. And if it fails any of that, then we kick it back to the developer, and we say, hey, look, this is on you. You need to fix this before it actually gets checked back into source. And so what we've done in 2010 is we've implemented that as a feature called gated check-in. So with gated check-in, the only thing I need to do here is say, check this radio button, gated check-in, and that's going to cause the workflow to require that your build runs first, all those build verification tests run, and then everything finally gets checked in. So obviously a best practice here is to make sure that if you have a huge suite of tests, as we all should, I know everyone in this room does, right? You may not want to run all those tests every single time because you may not want to, it may be, you know, cost prohibitive for you to have your check-ins wait for an hour prior to everything getting checked in. But there might be one or two simple checks that you can run that may catch 80% of the issues that are related to things that may have broken the build in the past. So I'll turn that into a gated check-in. We can ignore most of this stuff. We want to copy this down to drops. We know what we want to build, so this is the solution we'll be building. And then the retention policy. This is another feature we added in 2008. I kind of think of this as my TiVo capability. So, you know, I want to keep the last 10 Family Guys, but the last two Law and Orders and only the last one SNL, for example. So this is where you can say, I want to keep the last 10 successful builds. Anything that failed, I want to keep that as well. But if I actually stop a build, then maybe I only want to keep the last build. And this is just a nice way of keeping your build server clean. So at this point, we go ahead and save that. That shows up as a new build definition. Queue a new build. Actually, no, we don't have to queue a new build. What we can say is actually go ahead and make a change. So let's just simulate a change in here. Dev days. You guys in the front row are supposed to tell me that's not supposed to compile, right? All right, what do I know? So we'll go ahead and check this in. And of course, that's in the production branch, so I'm in the wrong branch. Come on, guys. I know it's after lunch, but you got to help me out here. Wake up, dev days. Okay. So, yep, that's going to should trigger a change. Let's go ahead and check that in. Now it's going to give me this fancy dialogue that says, you know what? Before those changes actually get committed, we want to build them. We need to make sure you're not breaking the build. So at this point, I could go ahead and say build changes. If I have permissions, I could bypass this. So I know some of you are wondering, well, you know, I've got to fast track a change. What happens if, you know, I really need to bypass the build verification test? So you could check this bottom box down here that says, go ahead and build my changes and commit them right away. But I'm not going to do that. We'll go ahead and say build changes. And at this point, it's going to go ahead and start building my software. So with that, we have about 2 minutes if anyone has any questions. Otherwise, I hope to see some of you in my next talk. And just a few resources for you. Once again, my blog is blogs.msdn.com/BRIANKEL. Yes? I missed the first part of your question. I'm sorry.
Can you have a hierarchy within, for example, user storage?
Oh, yes, you can absolutely do that. So let's say you have, so the question was, can you have a hierarchy within your different work items? Like, can I have like a feature catalog that shows here's a top level requirement and here's a sub level requirement, and maybe here's a, you know, feature or a value proposition? Yes, you can absolutely do that. By default, some of our queries show you a relationship between user stories and tasks. That's what I was working with here. But yes, you can absolutely relate that to in level of depth, really beyond whatever you need to do. So the question is, do we then roll up that data from the child items? And today we don't. Of course, you could write your own queries, you could write your own workbooks that do that, but roll up is one of those features that we were really excited to try and get into the product, and it just didn't make it. So roll up is definitely one of those capabilities we want to deliver in, Dev 11 is our code name right now. So, yeah, great question. Yeah.
Is there any timeline for having 64-bit unit tests working?
64-bit unit testing, I'm 90% confident that works today, actually, with 2010. So yes, I do believe that we support that. I don't know of any caveats, but that question comes up all the time, and I'm pretty sure that that works for you. Great question. Yeah. Yes. Great question. Are there any plans to host TFS in Windows Azure? It is something that we're looking at. It's not something that I would expect you would see in the next 10, 12 months or so, but it is something we're looking at. There's actually three or four partners. Dev Central is one of them that does host Team Foundation Server in the cloud today, not within Windows Azure, but kind of in their own environment. So if you just wanted to spin up a project that existed in the cloud and have everyone connect to it and not worry about doing backups yourself, you could definitely do that by taking advantage of one of those partners. But part of the reason that we architected TFS 2010 the way we did with that team project collection model is so that we could start to isolate work and make it much easier to enable future hosting environments like such as that. So, yeah, it's kind of hard to see. So, shout out if I'm missing you here. Yeah, thank you.
This side question, licensing.
Yes.
Access through the portal
to the client web access. Yes. Yeah, so licensing isn't one of those questions I can answer in 5 seconds, but basically licensing is very well addressed in a new white paper we published last month. It's a Visual Studio 2010 licensing white paper. If you search for that, it should come right up. The short answer is that anyone who connects to Team Foundation Server should have a client license, a client access license. There are some exceptions to that. For example, if you have someone who is a end user and all they do is they need to file bugs, then you can actually give them access to TFS to file bugs. They don't get to do other things with TFS, but that does not require Cal. There's a few other exceptions in there as well. They're all spelled out in the white paper. One thing thank you for asking me licensing question, because I did want to mention, if you buy Visual Studio 2010 with an MSDN subscription, everybody gets their own license of TFS server and TFS Cal. So what that means is, if you wanted to have, you know, if you've got 20 people on your team and everyone has an MSDN subscription and they each wanted to have their own TFS server sitting under their desk, you could do that at no additional cost. So with that, I think we're out of time. I'll stick around. I've got about an hour before my next session if you have any extra questions. Otherwise, I hope to see some of you at my next session. Thank you very much.